part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Is it just us? Is Wells joining us today, or is it?
He had to work today, unfortunately.
Got it. So it's just us two, huh?
Just us two cowboys.
Once again.
Yes.
Cowboys or anime pilots, mecha pilots.
I mean, I think cowboys can be mecha pilots too.
If you say so. Shall we get started with our interview?
Whenever you'd like.
Cool, man. All right. Welcome back to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I am saying welcome back because we have a very special guest returning. This is like your third time, correct?
Third time, yes. Third time is the charm.
Yeah. First time we talked about Frankenstein Unbound, right? That's the name of the...
Frankenstein the Unconquered.
The Unconquered. Damn it. I keep messing that up. I screwed it up at our Conan the Barbarian podcast too. I really should look at it before I get on air. I'm sorry. My brain has been... I'm actually like sort of on like day 10 of COVID. So I'm like...
Oh, geez.
Yeah. I'm okay.
Are you doing podcasts?
What's that?
And you're doing podcasts on COVID?
I am. Well, yes. I'm coming out of it. So I just still have a bit of a cloudy head, pardon my froggy throat and congestion. I can't seem to escape. But yeah, it's day 10. So I should be able to venture out of my house. So,
okay.
But I apologize. So it's do it again for me. Frankenstein the...
Unconquered.
Right. And then we had you on in December to talk about Conan the Barbarian, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, which you did not like.
A very Conan Christmas.
Yeah, very Conan Christmas, which you were not as crazy about as I or my co-host Evis, but you were a trooper. You stuck with us, stuck through it with us. So
it was a fine movie.
It's a good movie. I think it's a good movie. I like it, but I liked it more than you did, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And your name is Dalton K. Shannon, correct?
That is me. Yes.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Part-Time Fanboy.
Thanks for having me back.
Of course.
It's good. I always enjoy coming on the show.
Great. I appreciate you appreciating coming on the show. Like I said, my head is a little cloudy, so please forgive me. We also did our Rocky III episode yesterday. So my head is a little out of it this weekend. So I apologize. But we are here to discuss. We're not here to talk about Frankenstein the Unbound, right? Right?
Well, no, because it's Frankenstein the Unconquered.
Unconquered. God damn it. I keep messing it up. It's so terrible. Frankenstein the Unconquered. It cannot be conquered.
We'll just get a pull quote from you and it'll say Unbound and we'll just have to change the name of the book to Unbound. then you'll just be right. It'll be fine.
Oh, my brain. Unconquered. He cannot be conquered. That's what I have to remember. That he cannot. Frankenstein the Unconquered. We're here to talk about something else. You currently have a Kickstarter going. I like to always say at the top of the show, Kickstarter going on for something else, which the title I do know is called Mechaton, correct?
Mechaton, you got it.
Got it. Mechaton, like that, not like Mechaton. Mechaton, yeah. one syllable or two.
One, yeah.
Two
yeah.
One fast word. Syllables. Mechaton.
Mechaton.
Mechaton. That's awesome. And so while Frankenstein the Unconquered was kind of you delving into like sword and sandals, kind of like space sci-fi stuff, this is a bit of a different thing, right?
It's a very different thing. Yes. Frankenstein is a very mature book, hyper violence, over the top action and, very R rated. But Mechaton is more of our all ages book, in that, kids of all ages would be into it. So if you got a 6-year-old, a 12-year-old, or a 46-year-old, I think there's something to love about Mechaton.
I mean, it looks like a great book. I mean, so it's currently on Kickstarter now, and you're funding which issues, the 4 and 5?
Correct. Yes, we are funding 4 and 5. You can get all 5 issues on the campaign, though.
Nice, nice, nice. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I just saying we have all the issues available. It's never been a better time to jump in. If you've never checked out Mechaton before, you're getting 108 pages of story in this campaign. If you grab all 5 issues, and if you're an old mech head who's been with us from the beginning, we got 2 great new issues that kind of wrap up the first arc that we've been building towards.
Yeah. Yeah. So why don't you just go into like the quick pitch since we're talking about it? Like, let's start off with just like what it's about. I mean, obviously it's kind of like anime manga inspired sort of stuff, correct?
Right. Mechaton, in the simplest elevator pitch, is a glove falls from space. 2 siblings find it and discover that anything they punch with it turns into a giant mech. So that means hot dog carts, houses, city blocks, cars, anything they punch turn into mechs. They use to fight other kaiju, other mechs, government bodies, all sorts of crazy shenanigans. It's just as over the top as Frankenstein without all the hyperviolence.
That's that's funny though, because so the glove does not turn into something. You use the glove to punch something and that turns into something, right?
Right. The glove converts whatever it punches into the mech. Yes. Into it is the facilitator.
And do they crawl into the mech or do they control it via the glove? Like, how does the mechanics of all this work?
Well, if you're asking those questions, you're probably thinking too hard. But they punch it and then the material that is punched, like a car, starts to build and form the mech around the glove and up the arm, and it basically builds the mech around Derek, who is the wielder of the glove.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then Derek ends up in the cockpit by the end of the transformation.
Nice. Yeah, I've looked at the pages on Kickstarter, and I think we talked a little bit about this on one of our previous interviews, but it looks like a ton of fun.
Yes.
I'll say Mechaton, a ton of fun. I mean, come on, that has to have been used. Sorry. Can't be the first one that came up with that. But it looks like a really, really fun book, especially, like you said, for all ages, for kids of maybe a younger set. But it also looks very entertaining for those of us that have grown up with this sort of thing, which I have. Like, obviously, I think we've established in past interviews that I'm a little bit older than you, and I was growing up with, Battle of the Planets and Star Blazers and stuff like that. And, you know, eventually the Akira sort of anime invasion happened in the 90s and stuff like that. So, having spoken to you before and knowing that you know your shit, particularly about comics, I'm very curious about how, because this predates Frankenstein, correct?
It does, yeah. This Mechaton has existed in some form or another for like 10 years now.
Oh, wow.
And now in 2021, I believe, is when we published our first issue of Mechaton. So it's been with us for a long time.
Nice. Sorry, when was the first issue published again?
In 2021.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. So gotcha. A couple years. And is it being published in print through like Scout Comics? Did I see that?
Yeah. So we have teamed up with Scout. They are publishing Mechaton through their YA Scoot imprint.
Oh,
so nice. Issue number 1 is going to be hitting comic shop shelves on March 29th.
Oh, congratulations.
And, well, thank you. We're very excited to be working with Scout. They're great. But from there, they do a publishing strategy where they publish the first issue and then they publish the trade. So they get all that momentum from issue 1 into the trade. So, so the Kickstarters are really the only place you can get floppies for issue 2 through 5. If you're a floppies guy or a variant cover kind of guy. And then they will publish the trade that collects 1 through 5. And that will be in comic shops, hopefully later this year.
Oh, wow. Okay. So Scout Comics, I did not know this was a publishing strategy with them. I just thought that they were.
It was
like,
the first I had heard of it too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of interesting that they would focus on doing a first issue and then just be like, hey, the rest of the series, we're just going to put in trade and not even deal with floppies for the rest of the series. That's an interesting, like, is that just like kowtowing sort of to like the speculator, like comic market, like that sort of thing for first issue?
I know Scout as Scout's main publishing arm publishes single issues.
Yeah.
They do miniseries, but I think it's specifically Scoot that does this this type of publishing model because it does cater to a younger crowd, this line of books. And younger kids love comic books, but they don't necessarily come into comic shops and grab single issues. They want the collected editions.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think to me, the reasoning would be the first issue introduces the book. It kind of gets people excited for the book, whether you're an adult in the comic shop or a kid or whatever. And then when the trade comes out, you're more likely to, you've had a taste, so to speak, of that first issue, and you'll be more likely to check out the trade, and the trade will move better because of that. Yeah.
That is an interesting strategy. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. I've never really heard anyone doing that sort of thing because, I mean, it also seems like a bit of double dipping, right? But I mean, if you can get somebody hooked into the first issue, how much time between the time that the first issue is published and then, you may have already said this, and again, my head is cloudy, and the trade comes out? Like, how much of a time gap is there?
Well, it's going to be a second because, like I said, we are in the process of funding 4 and 5 right now.
Oh, okay.
Issue 4 is being colored right now.
Okay.
And issue 5, all the line art is done. So we're just basically waiting on colors and letters for issue 4 and 5. And then those will get sent out to backers, and then we'll send them off to Scoot. And sometime later this year, I would think, but you know, solicitations are always 3 months out, and they're already put out for May right now. So I would anticipate sometime in the fall, but I have no actual idea on the street date for that trade.
Oh, and is the trade's publication dependent upon this campaign funding, like reaching its goal?
I mean, it's more or less, okay. Because we need, like I said, the issues are already pretty much in the bag. The Kickstarter is a way for us to make sure we don't put ourselves in a hole financially for the books. And once all the work's done, then yeah, it goes. The campaign more or less is to make sure that trade happens, but it's also so that people can get their individual copies of number 4 and 5 or variant covers, or, you know, if you want to complete the set of your single issues, that's what the campaign is really for. And then the fact that we're going to have those issues for the trade is a bonus.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. So Kickstarter is your way of producing the individual single issues for those people that have already, you've done the first 3 through Kickstarter. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So you're wrapping
it's our main form of publication.
Gotcha. 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 Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. That makes sense. Understood. Okay. Oh, that's cool. That's an interesting way to go about it. I mean, it's interesting that you are sort of funding, you know, the single issues through Kickstarter, and that's a way to sort of like grow your audience. And then Scout Comics is like, okay, we'll publish the first issue. And then later on down the line, I guess, like, for me, the question is like, you're doing the Kickstarter now, but if the trade doesn't come until the fall or something like that, how are you keeping up that momentum, at least in shops, right?
Right. It probably comes down on, like a lot of the modern comics landscape.
Yeah.
It comes down to the creators to make sure that momentum stays.
Gotcha. So more podcast interviews.
Basically, we'll probably be doing a good set before the trade comes out, I would imagine.
Cool.
Comic publishers and tend to have a hard time like promoting their comic books outside of comic shops and things like that. So, you see it all the time on like Twitter. Individual creators have to go out and really push that a book they're working on is coming out.
Yeah.
A lot of the time it falls to the creators, and that's okay. We're fine doing it. It's just another part of creating comics that you may not know about when you jump in feet first.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, congratulations on getting that deal regardless. And
thank you. Yeah, Scout's been great to work with.
That's great.
They've really let us just do our book. They have like edits every night, like any editors do.
Sure.
Some grammatical stuff, some questions, but they've really let us have full reign over our baby here. And they just want to help us make it the best that it can be.
Yeah, no, I've interviewed other Scout Comics creators, and they have nothing but nice things to say about the publisher. Yeah. I've just never heard of this strategy before. It sounds very interesting, and I'd love to, either on a podcast or, just via email or whatever, stay in touch and be like, oh, how does that work? How did that work out for you? Because I find it really fascinating, because especially the interest in sort of like single issues, like how do you find obviously you're doing a Kickstarter, you've done several successful Kickstarters, but is that's sort of the question lately, right? Can floppy survive, right? Like, or for me, at least it's been that way for years. What is your sort of take on that, like in general?
I think it's inevitable that floppies are going to vanish.
I
don't want that because I'm a floppy guy myself.
Sure.
But I do think it's inevitable. I think the reading audience has moved on from the 20 odd pages of story a month.
Yeah.
They kind of, especially, and I think the industry kind of shot itself in the foot at the turn of the millennium, turn of the century, where a lot of writers would start writing with a trade mentality, which made a lot of single issues not feel as substantial. The industry itself started to undervalue the single issue.
Yeah.
And because of that, the trade became more desirable, which I don't blame anyone for wanting more substantial chunks of content at a time.
Yeah.
For me, I've always loved that that kind of syndicated storytelling that things like television and comics provide, where I get to check in with my favorite stories every so often, rather than every few years like film or novels do.
Yeah.
I think it's inevitable that we will move towards a collected edition and a, like series of graphic novels. If not completely in that vein, then single 20-page issues, chapters will probably move into the realm of digital exclusives. Maybe things like, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, they'll continue to publish single issues at like a higher priced collector's market, I would imagine.
Oh.
But I do not see floppies making it to like the 2040s, honestly.
2040, that's a little ways off. No, but I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because when I was sicker with COVID several days ago, I got a call from my little nephew right before bed, and he knew that I liked comics, and he had gone to a comic shop. And he was like, Uncle Christian, I was at the comic shop and I didn't know what to pick out. Like, I wanted a comic book. Like, I didn't want a book. Like, he was fixated on getting the floppies. And I was like, well, I was talking to his mom, who's my sister-in-law. And I was basically like saying like, Superman can be safe, like maybe Spider-Man and stuff like that for his age. There's definitely like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle books. But at the same time, I kind of had to walk him through the speech that I always gave to my daughter when we went to the comic shop. I was like, you can have this for like $5 to $6, which you'll be done with in a second. Or you can hit the 50% off and find a trade with the same characters, or you can get a trade for full price and you're still paying less than what you would pay for 5 to 6 issues of that, and kind of like walking him through the math and, and just the economics of like my experience. Like, what do you want more? Do you want this just like single issue, which you'll be done in 5 minutes, or do you want this book, and you'll pay a little more, but you'll get more too. Right. And so as a parent and as somebody who, walked his daughter through reading comics and collecting comics and was kind of giving his nephew advice, like I myself am like, dude, like the single issue comics are great, but you know, the trade is where you're going to get, you know, your big chunk of like, you know, enjoyment, in my opinion, anyway. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it's also because, modern, especially modern, superhero comics, big two comics, they don't make the single issue, accessible.
Yeah.
Even 20 plus years ago, when I got my first issue of Spider-Man, like it was part of a larger narrative, but that one issue had a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
It was self-contained. I understood the players and I got a full package and then of course it had to be continued at the bottom. And I was like, oh, okay, I got to get the next one.
Yeah.
But now, like, you go pick up an issue of Spider-Man and it's part of a larger narrative, but it feels like they just kind of arbitrarily cut the end, and then, you know, they took a big six issue thing and decided arbitrarily where to cut the ending. So it doesn't feel like you're getting a full story every month.
Yeah.
It feels like you're just getting a sample of a larger story. And yeah. If they wanted to promote the floppies in a way that would make them more accessible, then they would need to start treating them like their own important pieces of storytelling, floppies are in a weird place, and I really like that mentality of every issue is somebody's first, potentially.
Sure.
And if you're not making each issue special, then you don't need to be doing individual issues. It's the same same kind of thing I have against like streaming exclusive shows like Stranger Things.
Uh-huh.
If you just watched one episode a week, I don't know how substantial that's going to feel in those kind of chunks. It's meant to be binged in one long setting,
yeah,
much like a lot of single issue big two comics are now.
Yeah.
They're meant to be read as part of a larger story rather than a month to month, even though they're still publishing in a format that requires month to month. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and it's kind of frustrating as a reader and a creator, because like with Mechaton, we try very hard to have each issue be its own thing so that you don't feel like you're, because we trust our readers. We don't feel like we have to do the old Stan Lee thing where we recap every single thing that happened in the past 17 years of Mechaton in this issue.
Yeah.
So that you can know what's going on.
Yeah.
But so, you know, we expect you to have a baseline understanding of what Mechaton is, but from there, each issue is its own thing. Yeah. Each issue has its own beginning, middle, end. And of course, we're building towards a larger narrative. We have three acts that we want to tell. We have about 15 issues, and each one builds into the next in one kind of direct, one huge story. We want to make sure that, especially in a format like Kickstarter, where you're not guaranteed a book a month. Like it's been a few years now and we're just now getting 4 and 5 out just because of the way Kickstarter works for indie publishing. So we definitely want to make sure that if you're funding issue 4 and 5, that like we understand you may not have read issue 1 through 3 in a while. So we want to make sure we're not just assuming you have the Mechaton Encyclopedia in your head.
Yeah.
Like, we want to make sure that you're caught up in a way and have it be, it's frustrating, but I still love them. I'm the guy who complains about it, and I still pick up Superman every month. Like,
oh, do you really? Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Oh, I am a diehard floppy guy. I love the format of the single issue comic book.
Yeah.
It's my preferred way of reading. And
yeah,
when they're done right, I don't think, especially in that soap opera way that comics, superhero comics in particular, are really well suited for. Like when you look at Claremont's X-Men run, that 15 year long, like magnum opus, like each issue was its own thing. And then like he was building narratives in and out of A and B plots for 15 years. And
yeah,
when you read that thing in its entirety, like that could not have been, I don't think it would have landed as well if they had been like a series of graphic novels rather than,
sure,
you keeping up with your soaps,
well,
every month.
Don't you,
for the X-Men.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole Chris Claremont. I mean, there was a point where it just went out of control, where like obviously he couldn't maintain the thread, right? And how can you expect somebody who's been writing on a title that long and then with so many other titles tacked on to it and ancillary stuff? So it's like, I got to give Chris Claremont his due. I always will. But there was definitely an era of frustration in the mid to late 80s and early 90s where it was like, dude, you just dropped this whole Phoenix thing. Like, she just disappeared. Rachel Summers, like, what happened? Like, I don't even know what's going on, you know? And then you would read, you know, so, I mean, there is something to be said about, if you are a singular creator on your own title, like something like Invincible or something like that,
Invincible
and you can keep it going, you know, then that makes sense. But like with the corporate books, you know, especially Superman as an example, where they had to put like shields, like numbered shields on the cover so you could keep track of like what to, like, it's just ridiculous. So
they could have just made Superman a weekly book, but they decided to do that instead.
And it was just all over the place and it's different creators and sometimes they're not always able to line up. But I mean, for you, the thing that I wanted to ask you about, because obviously you've been successful on Kickstarter, you've been able to fund your books. Like, how do fans react, or how do you work on, you know, your single 20 pages or 30 pages of issues, and like, how do people react to getting those chunks of stories, you know, every couple of months and stuff like that? Because what you're doing now is almost releasing, you know, one big chunk of the trade in one Kickstarter campaign. But previous to this, you've done three issues, right? And you were doing one at a time, correct?
Right. We have been pretty lucky in that everyone has been pretty, I haven't heard any negative flack for the fact that the books don't feel substantial on their own, which I'm glad about. It would be so easy just to, you know, make a 5-issue thing and each issue just is one straight line to the end and it doesn't feel like, that maybe issue 3 just doesn't feel like there's a lot going on there, but I think it comes down to structure and knowing like what needs to be in each issue. Like we always kind of want to make it a point to have a cool new mech in every issue so that there's like some cool thing on the page in any given chapter. And then of course you want to keep that plot moving pretty quick, especially if you're only working in a 20-page format.
Yeah.
But we haven't had I haven't seen any complaints about pacing or structure or, you know, feeling like they weren't getting their money's worth with it. And now that we're releasing 2 issues rather than 1, I mean, that was also kind of on our part, just wanting to not spend the rest of our lives making Mechaton, because It's 15 issues and...
Oh, wow. Really? So you're only a third of the way through with this, right?
Right. Yeah. Wow. And we knew that if we were going just one book every Kickstarter, this is going to take a while unless we get picked up by a publisher to go on a monthly basis or something.
Yeah.
So we wanted to kind of double up and give people more story and also cut down on shipping costs. But that way you're not having to pay shipping on issue 4 and 5. You're just paying one shipping for this collection here. But it is still, it's not just one 40-page issue. It's still 2 20-page issues, 4 and 5. It's the way it was supposed to be consumed. It's the way it's supposed to be read.
Yeah.
If we wanted to make it one big issue, we would have to do some restructuring. Because there's because every issue ends on a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And if you put that in the middle of a 40-page issue, it's going to feel a little weird. there's all sorts of things to consider when you're thinking about length and pacing and making sure that what you have in those 20 pages is the best you can put in those 20 pages.
Yeah.
Rather than arbitrarily having a cutoff for the story.
It's interesting. We kind of went off on a little tangent about like the ins and outs of like reading comics and creating comics, and I don't want to get too far away from like Mechaton itself, but I mean, that's one of the things that I remember our last interview where, I mean, you just mentioned Chris Claremont's like run on the X-Men. And I think we established that I might be like 20 years older than you. And I'm like,
yeah, Claremont's run ended before I was born.
Yeah. So I'm like, there's a lot of times where I'm like, how the hell did this guy discover Chris Claremont's run and like read it and like go through it? But I mean, you know, in relation to Mechaton, what was some of your early exposure to this? And I'm assuming just because this predates Frankenstein, the Unconquered, I got it right, that this predates Frankenstein, the Unconquered. Was this your first comic that you worked on?
No.
What was previous to this? There was something else, right?
Stuff that's been published, yes.
Yeah.
We had a horror anthology called Descent into Dread published through Caliber Comics.
Okay.
That came out in 2020. And then Wells and I also did our own homemade little ash cans. That's where Frankenstein first showed up. That's where a lot of our smaller ideas that necessarily we didn't think necessarily had enough legs for their own series, we put in little 8-page one shots. I drew them and then we took them to conventions and sold them as ash cans. I've been making comics since I found out what comics were, and I've got binders and binders full of scripts and outlines and plots of all sorts of stuff. Mechaton was just one of them that I brought to Wells, and I was like, I think this is cool.
Yeah,
we should totally do this. And he was like, we can work with this. This is good. Mechaton has been a long time coming, but it's by no means the oldest property in the binder of ideas, so to speak.
Got it. But why a manga sort of all ages inspired book as like your first sort of, I mean, this wasn't your first Kickstarter project either, right? Like,
it was.
Oh, yes. It was. Okay. So then
Mechaton was the first one we brought to Kickstarter.
So then I'm on the right track. Why like your sort of first like diving into Kickstarter, making a big splash like on the internet with this idea, you know, when you've got binders and binders, like were you a big manga, mecha, anime head when you were younger?
Not so much. I am a big kaiju fan. I don't remember a world without Godzilla in it.
Okay.
Like
really?
There are, I can tell you what my life was like before I found out who Spider-Man was. And then after, I couldn't tell you, I don't remember a world without Godzilla. Like it's always been in my life. And so I've just grown up absorbing Godzilla and Ultraman. And as I got older into like high school and college, I got really into anime, and specifically mecha anime. I like big monsters, so I also love big robots.
Sure.
So I got really into those, and then me and my buddy in college, we had just gone on like this big bender of mecha anime, and we were just kind of spitballing ideas, and then one of us said, what if a glove turned things into robots? And we're like, done, that's perfect. I went and I wrote the first script probably that weekend, and then it kind of sat on the shelf for like 8 years. But we thought Mechaton was the best option for our first big ongoing series. We had just done Descent into Dread. And we also had Frankenstein in the binder because, you know, we had those ash cans. He was in the Dread anthology. And so we were like, Frank has legs. We could give Frank his own series. But if we do that after Dread, that kind of makes us the horror guys.
Mm.
We kind of want to have more of a breadth to our body of work that we can do different kinds of genres. And we didn't just want to be another indie superhero book on Kickstarter. So like any sort of superhero ideas are out the window. And anything else that was like in the binder, so to speak, was a little more half formed and would take a little more work to kind of get off the ground. But Mechaton had, like I said, it had an entire first script ready to go.
Uh-huh.
It was super accessible. It didn't take itself too seriously. Mm. And it just seemed very open and kind of a natural introduction. If nobody read Dread, this was a great place to go. If you did read Dread, then this is a nice change of pace. Like it just felt the natural next step from a horror anthology.
Sure, sure. So I'm fascinated by this concept of growing up without Godzilla, because like, or with Godzilla, like from the beginning, mm-hmm. not knowing what, like, and the description on your page is for this project is Scott Pilgrim meets Pacific Rim, which I think is great mm-hmm. because it definitely visually evokes that. Who's the artist again?
Fernando Pinto. Yeah, he's a Chilean art professor. Great guy.
I just followed him on Instagram. So, yeah.
He's in a punk rock band too. So, like,
oh really?
He's just he's everything I want to be. Is what he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, his work is really cute and very energetic and stylish, and I think it definitely fits the project. And that description of Scott Pilgrim meets Pacific Rim is looks pretty dead on. But, like. Who introduced you to Godzilla? Like, because not everyone can say that, right? Like, I mean, there's, you know, Godzilla seems to me to be more my generation than it would be like your generation, right? Unless your first exposure was the awful, like, Matthew Broderick movie.
98 Godzilla.
Yeah, 98 Godzilla, which then I feel bad because, like, but like, how... Who was it your parents, like your dad, was somebody like hardcore into Godzilla?
Okay. I honestly couldn't tell you, that's how like ingrained in my identity Godzilla is. Like I
you don't remember the first one you saw, or was it just like a toy or something?
So when I was young, I distinctly remember having a double VHS set. Uh-huh. And it had Godzilla King of the Monsters, the Americanized version of Gojira.
Yeah.
From 56.
The black and white one, right?
With Raymond Burr.
Yeah.
And it also had Godzilla versus Megalon.
Okay.
And I remember being little and like I got bored to tears in King of the Monsters because Godzilla, I mean, that was the art house, that was like the best Godzilla film because it's like one that has something to say and is like an art house film almost.
Sure.
Or at least Gojira is. King of the Monsters, but anyway, Megalon I watched on repeat because that had giant monsters fighting. But I don't know why I would have that double VHS tape unless I believe there was either a friend of the family or maybe it was my uncle. But somebody somewhere had a VHS copy of King Kong versus Godzilla.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
And I remember watching that one on repeat over and over again. And I don't know why my parents would get me a double set of Godzilla if I wasn't already introduced to King Kong versus Godzilla. So
sure.
it had to be that copy of King Kong versus Godzilla, but I could not tell you whose it was. I don't know when I first saw it.
Yeah.
It's always been a staple. And then as I got older, I went and found every film I could, all the old Marvel comics from the 70s I devoured. Thankfully, being a child of the 2000s, that was when Marvel and DC were publishing those like phone book size black and white reprints, the Essentials and Showcase Presents. Yeah. I love those things. I have so many of them. They did one for the Godzilla series. So I was able to read that whole 70s Godzilla series.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think I have some of the comics in my collection, but I didn't know that they did an Essentials for that. That's great. Yeah,
I've actually been trying to get that whole set. Those are hard to find.
I'm sure.
It's always been a part of my life, and I've been consuming Godzilla content ever since.
Really? That's you're so fascinating to me because I'm always just blown away by meeting younger people and how they're into the same thing. Like I meet people that are younger than me and they're like so into 80s music and they know everything about like Daryl Hall and John Oates. And I'm like, you realize that you weren't even like around, but somehow you know everything about Daryl, like why? Like I don't even like, and I'm always just fascinated by that sort of thing. But I guess when I was growing up, and I was talking to my daughter about this just the other day, that like in the 80s, you know, it was 50s and 60s music that was like the nostalgia was coming back. So maybe it seeped through somehow. Have you read The Half Century War, the Godzilla
book? I love that stuff. Stokoe's art is, oh my God.
What's the creator's name?
James Stokoe?
Stokoe. Okay. I always forget how to pronounce the last name. He is like, I look at his stuff and it makes me want to cry, especially as an artist. Like, I'm like, how?
Yeah.
how do you have the energy to do all this? Like, you know, and as far as I know, it's all traditional, right? So I'm just
I believe he's a traditional artist. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just, oh my God. It makes me want to cry. I'm just like, oh.
The IDW stuff they've been doing for the past like decade have been pretty great.
Oh, really? Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's hits and misses, but overall I've enjoyed, like, they did a series, Godzilla in Hell, and Stoko came back.
Oh, I heard about issues. That. Yeah.
Just Godzilla fighting demons in hell. Like, that's just
that
great.
Sounds awesome. That sounds amazing. It's so funny too, because it's also funny, like, the effect that different generations, that Godzilla will have on different generations, because they used to run Godzilla movies on WPIX Channel 11 in New York, New Jersey, all the time, like Saturday or Sunday mm-hmm. afternoons. Can't remember. And so if you were a kid at home, And you were bored on a Saturday afternoon, which many of us were, because we, mm-hmm. you know, it was like heaven, you know. But the thing of it is my reaction to King of the Monsters, even the Americanized version, that thing freaked me the fuck out, like, when I was a yeah. kid, because I was growing up in the 80s and the threat of nuclear war. And it was just, even as a young kid, it was obvious, like, what this was about, right? Like, mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, this is about nuclear war.
Raymond Burr spells it out.
Yeah. Hard. Nuclear weapons and stuff like that. And so I remember not being bored by it, but just being, particularly in the beginning, especially, and then having seen Gojira, like the original, years later in the theater, you know, subtitled and stuff. But I just, when I was really young, that King of the Monsters freaked me the hell out. Like, I can't mm-hmm. even tell you. Like, I was just like, you know, because you couldn't see it. Like, you were just like, what yeah. is it? I didn't know what to expect. I'll never forget seeing it on TV for the first time and just being like, what is this? And then obviously yeah. it's like this giant lizard thing, you know, monster. But yeah. that's so great. That's awesome that you were exposed to that when you were young.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's got to be one of the great horrors of the modern era, where I think one of the reasons that I was able to get into a lot of this old stuff is because it was around, like, sure. the physical ephemera
yeah,
was
yeah,
just
yeah.
around, whether it was VHS tapes or vinyl records or cassette tapes.
Yeah.
They were just in the house because that's what my parents had or whatever.
Yeah.
And now it's like everything is digital, and yeah. it's going to be so much harder for a kid to find something like that and then, like, go into a rabbit hole on Wikipedia, which is all I did as a kid. I yeah. would find something that was cool, and I would rabbit hole Wikipedia, and I'd find out everything about it, and I'd become obsessed with it. And it's going to be harder when there's not something just in the house that kind of piques your, like, you're not going to find a Hall & Oates album just kind of sitting around.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to have to, like, deliberately seek it out on Spotify.
Yeah, there's not a lot of discovering stuff by accident, it seems like, these days, yeah, right?
I mean, it's definitely we're seeing a good trend where people are starting to be like, oh, streaming, maybe it's not the solution we all thought it was.
Yeah, when yeah.
a giant corporation can take it away at any moment.
Yeah.
And I think we are starting to see more of a love for physical media.
Yeah, heck yeah.
So it was so funny. I went and bought an album a few months ago. I got it on vinyl for the house, and then I got the CD for my car. And the kid at the kid at the counter, he was probably like, I don't know, 16. He was like, oh dude, true fan. And I was like, well, yeah, I'm buying two copies. He's like, no, you're buying physical stuff at all, like, true fan.
That's awesome.
I was like, is that just not what people do?
But yeah.
But so I think it's definitely a possibility for that kind of discovery to come back. And, you know, people are always going to be curious.
Yeah, for sure. As long as they keep making the things that play them, like, they've started taking, like, CD players out of cars and stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah. But as long as you have those disc drives, I think we're, you know, in good DVD players and Blu-ray players or whatever. Yeah. And hopefully we'll still be in good shape. But So Godzilla is something that you become kind of obsessed with when you're younger. What makes the jump to, like, giant mecha and stuff like that, like giant robots and stuff? Is it Ultraman? Is Ultraman the first thing you discover? Or?
I mean, I did watch some Ultraman when I was younger. Uh-huh. Ultraman Tiga was on
Fox wow.
when I was a kid.
Okay.
So
were
I
you a Power Rangers kid?
I was not allowed to be a Power Rangers kid.
Oh, really? Why not? Yeah,
I just said I'm a very obsessive kid.
Yeah.
And so when I was young, I was really into Godzilla and Batman and Spider-Man and all of these like action heavy things. And I would just go around the house and I would like be punching and kicking and doing all this crazy stuff. And I saw Power Rangers and I was like, that's cool. And my mom was like, there's enough punching and kicking in this house.
Yeah.
I don't think we should, I think you'll be okay without Power Rangers.
Absolutely not. She was like, no.
I didn't grow up with Power Rangers. I've been getting into more of that as I'm older, like the Super Sentai stuff from Japan and all that. But now Mecha didn't really take hold until high school when my best friend, he got really into the anime rabbit hole that something like Toonami provided.
Okay.
So he introduced me basically to anime in general because I didn't watch Dragon Ball or Pokemon or anything.
Got it.
I was very much a westernized kid outside of Godzilla.
Okay.
So him introducing me to things like Gundam and Gurren Lagann and Code Geass, all of these great mecha shows, it really just fed something that I didn't know needed nourishment. And I became obsessed once again. And then that kind of fed into Godzilla and a big feedback loop that gave us Mechaton.
What do you think it was about that sucked you in? Because I know at least for anime, for me, even when I was young, Battle of the Planets, like Star Blazers, it was the quality of the artwork, right? And it was it was so beautiful. Different than anything else I'd seen on American TV. Mm-hmm. Like I loved like Super Friends and Scooby-Doo and, you know, all that stuff, Thundar the Barbarian. But when Battle of the Planets came on the first time and I was like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. Like I was just blown away. And
Hanna-Barbera can't compete with Gainax. Like,
yeah, it's just like, what happened? So like, what is it for you that sucked you in? Was it the artwork or was it the stories? Like, was it the kinetic energy of it all? Like what was it that sucked you in?
At the time, you know, every teenager is an insufferable prick. So I still am.
What are you talking about?
It says a lot.
I can't even remember the name of your book, Dalton. I'm a terrible person. Anyway, go on.
So I'm pretty sure it was the stories, like, or at least the promise of the stories, and the visual flair of something like a mecha anime has, like the style, the aesthetics, like it draws you in, and then the story kind of keeps you there, and it was telling stories that I had not seen in animation here in the States.
Yeah.
So getting a chance to really, and also a lot of mecha shows do not play with the same tropes that I had associated with the format of anime. Like I always just assumed that it was all like Dragon Ball or it was all like Pokemon and it was all like this insufferable over the top nonsense. And now that I'm older, I'm fine with the over-the-top nonsense like Dragon Ball rocks. But at the time, I was not ready to admit that.
Yeah.
So the mecha shows offered me a way to kind of fall into the aesthetics of anime.
Yeah.
Without having the without it looking as goofy as something like Dragon Ball, I guess. So I wasn't embarrassed to watch it as a teenager.
Yeah.
And then by the time I hit college, it was like, who cares? Like all of this stuff is cool.
Yeah.
And it's all a part of the identity now.
Sure. Sure. So let me ask you this question and you know, there's so much of it out there, right? Like anime, like I've gotten to the point where it's just like, for me lately, I can't find like an anime series that I can like really get hooked into. Like that really captures me. And maybe it's just my attention span has changed from since I was younger or there's so much of it out there. But what are the challenges of that? Like with you and Mechaton, because there is a lot. So what makes Mechaton unique, you know, versus like the years and, you know, literally decades of like giant robot fighting kaiju stuff that's been out there. I mean, obviously I can see an enthusiasm on the page, you know, on the pages that I see, but like, what do you think separates Mechaton apart from, so like, let's say that this is in somebody's wheelhouse, which it's definitely in my wheelhouse. Right. But what makes me want to like check it out, you know, and, you know, not be so derivative than what's come before. Am I making any sense?
Yeah. I think on the surface, what sets Mechaton apart is the like the ability for creative decisions. Like, it's a story about thinking on your feet and kind of working with what you've got. And the Mechaton glove, like, in its very core, is about making different mechs out of things you wouldn't expect. So it's not all just different types of Gundams. It's literally like, that one's made out of a car. That one's made out of a pile of trash. That one's made out of a city block. Like, each mech is super unique, and you don't always know what kind of, like, weaponry comes with it. Each one is unique. And Derek kind of has to think on his feet with his sister Leah to figure out how to operate the mech within a time frame that they don't end up dead.
I was just gonna. Fighting. That's a great idea. That each new mech is like they have. He has to learn how to use it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
That's very clever.
So that is like the aesthetic difference, I think. But then, like, the core difference is in the characters themselves. Derek and Leah are brother and sister, which is something that you see sibling relationships in media, but I've never been completely satisfied with sibling relationships. They always feel either too perfect or too antagonistic, to where they're bitter rivals and they just can't get over how much they hate each other. But Derek and Leah, Wells and I both are siblings, so we wanted to write from our experience with our brothers.
Sure.
And, you know, that sibling relationship where you would die for them, but if they breathe at you wrong, you will kill them.
Yeah.
Like, Derek and Leah have a very, like, pure, honest, loving relationship that is undercut with jabs and jokes that really only siblings get to make at each other. Like, if they were just best friends or if they were dating, it would be a completely different dynamic. But because they're siblings, you get to have a lot of fun with the way they treat each other and the way they interact with the world. And especially because Derek, well, I like to joke that they both share one brain cell between them. And Derek is like a bit of a slouch. Like, he just kind of wants to play video games. He's got a really good heart and he wants to help people. He just doesn't really know how to do that. And if he was in the mech all by himself, he would probably end up making stupid decisions and die immediately. But Leah is a little more self-centered. Leah is an artist. She likes to pretend she has a plan, and she's kind of his backseat gamer. She's the one calling the shots from the ground. So, like, her phone has access to the intricacies of the Mechaton glove, so she can kind of see what Derek's got in the arsenal, so to speak. And so she can kind of direct him to fight the mech. And if Leo was by herself, then she doesn't have the wherewithal to take the action. She just knows what she should do, but she might freeze up in a sense.
Sure.
So they have a really great dynamic that's a lot of push and a lot of pull and a lot of tension, but it's also a lot of love and a lot of jokes. And I think those two reasons are kind of what set Mechaton apart from a lot of the mecha before. And also, you know, you just get really cool robots. Like, who doesn't want cool robots?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask about. How hard is it to come up with new mecha? And then how hard is it to translate what you want to Fernando and for him to come back with, like, oh, and, you know, I mean, it looks like it works on the pages that I'm seeing, but how challenging is that to be like, I got to come up. He just did the hot dog vendor he just did a washing machine, or like, how hard is it for you guys to, you know, come up with new stuff all the time?
Yeah, we definitely have like a list of mechs that we want to get through. And it's not comprehensive by any means. There's still some holes. And that's kind of the fun of it. Like, we know by issue, seven, for instance, we want him to punch this thing, and that's a dramatic point for the story. But issue five or issue, 9, like, I don't really know what the mech looks like in issue 9. So when the story gets us there, then we're kind of like Derek and Leah, and we're like, okay, what do we have around us? What can we use here for the mech? And once we decide what the mech is being converted from, that's when we start to really dig in and be like, okay, what kind of weaponry would a house have? A chimney cannon. That sounds great. We'll do it. We'll do that. And there's all sorts of, it's a lot of like improv in that regard.
Sure.
When we're creating the mechs. But then it's super easy for us to tell Fernando, because we're just like, and then the hot dog cart becomes a robot.
Well, that's
what. And then Fernando has to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And,
yeah.
And to his credit, Fernando, like, this is a very difficult book to work on. Like, we're asking a lot of Fernando to be able to come up with a brand new robot design basically every issue, and for it to look cool and like be easy to draw panel to panel. And dude, knocks it out of the park every single time. Like, we've never had like notes on the mechs.
Oh, that's great.
They always come out great. We have a great relationship with Fernando, and we kind of have similar vibes and tastes when it comes to mechs and kind of how they function and how they look. And we've never had a problem.
So he's never been like, really, guys, a hot dog cart? Like, really?
Oh, no. He's been open from day one. He's got a lot of, he's like an old school like comics head too. So he likes a lot of the same artists I do, and like the kind of insane manga influences of somebody like Joe Mod.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So like there's a lot of energy there, and that enthusiasm to draw the action in this book and the different kinds of mechs and the different kaiju as well. All of it, I couldn't think of anybody better for it than Fernando.
Nice, nice. No, I mean, the book looks great. Everything looks like super fun. You should, you can use my quote, mechaton looks like a ton of fun. Like, it does look like
we'll,
that.
We'll put that next to the 15 others that say that.
Yeah. Oh, come on. No, I thought I was original. No, I mean, it does look like a really super great, fun, all ages, like, romp. I mean, I just, I can't wait to check it out myself. I'll be contributing to the Kickstarter once we get off of this interview. Any sort of big final thoughts on this?
Mechaton, I know that we've been saying all ages a lot this episode, and, you know, it's kind of the easy way to sell the book, but, I know that it can turn some people off. From wanting to check out an all ages. But for me, all ages basically means like a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
Like if your kids are going to see a Marvel movie, then that Marvel movie is by its definition kind of all ages. Like it's built for the widest possible net. And if you're an adult going to see a Marvel movie, well, one, you have questionable taste, but two, you know what you're getting into. Like it's not going to be just like a kids fest. Like it's not going to be like going to see the Mario movie or something.
Sure.
So
it's Mechaton, not going to be painful. It's not a painful read. It's open to everyone, right? Like
Mechaton,
the Incredibles.
Incredibles is a great example. It is an Incredibles is an all ages movie that is not a kids movie. Mechaton is kind of in that same vein. Like anyone can pick this book up and find something to enjoy, whether it's the robots, the relationships, or, you know, just the art itself. Like if you're just in it for the art's fantastic. And we have a bunch of variant covers. And if you want to own a page of the art, you can do that on this Kickstarter.
Oh, great.
All 5 issues are available on the Kickstarter. If you've never checked us out, never been a better time to jump in. Like you said, it's a ton of fun.
Well, you are always very gracious to have come on this podcast for the 3rd time. You are, you're a very good guest to talk to, Dalton K. Shannon. I enjoy having a conversation, even if you don't like the Conan the Barbarian movie that Arnold Schwarzenegger starred in the 80s.
Nobody's
perfect. It's true. It's true. But Mechaton looks like it's perfect. So people should go to Kickstarter and check this out. Mechaton is MECHATON, not MEK or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's Mecha, mechaton. And this looks like I said, like a ton of fun, very exciting, very action packed, and very humorous too, it looks like. So Scott Pilgrim meets Pacific Rim. That's a great pitch right there.
Cool. Well, thanks so much. I love coming on the show. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you for saying you love coming on this show. I appreciate that. Again, the gentleman's name is, oh my God, Dalton. Oh God.
Dalton the Unbound.
Dalton. Oh, sorry. My brain just freaking. Dalton K. Shannon. Sorry. I apologize. Again, my head is a little cloudy. Again, the gentleman's name is Dalton K. Shannon. The project is Mechaton. It is on Kickstarter right now. Please go help throw some money at it. It is definitely worth your time. Just by what I'm seeing, it looks like a very fun issue. And thank you for checking out this episode of Part-Time Fanboy. My cloudy-headed name is Christian Horn. You could check us out on parttimefanboy.com. My email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We are on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Please check out Dalton K. Shannon's book, Mechaton, on Kickstarter. Bye.
Part-time fanboy.